Good day. Today is Thursday, 27th November 2025, and let me first of all begin this programme by wishing everybody in the United States and elsewhere where Thanksgiving is celebrated a happy Thanksgiving holiday. Now, before proceeding with this video, there are unfortunately a few unpleasant, there is one unpleasant thing to discuss, which is that as a number of you have pointed out to me in emails and messages that I have been receiving, and as I have myself seen on YouTube, there is a phony channel pretending to be connected to myself, in which there is an AI produced image of myself repeating some of the points which I have made in various programs. From what I can tell, and I haven't obviously watched this program through, it is a pastiche of various comments that I have made in recent videos. Anyway, the point is that this thing has absolutely nothing to do with me. It is not authorized. It is not something that I approve of or knew anything about until it appeared, and members of the community hopefully and kindly pointed out to me that it was happening. Now, we have, that is to say that Duran, Alex and I, we have complained about this channel to YouTube. I expect that at some point over the next few hours, it will be taken down. But I have been here previously in the past. I can remember some years ago that there was a whole cluster of fake channels pretending to be connected to me, publishing excerpts, unauthorized excerpts from my videos. This is a little more sophisticated. This latest attempt is a little bit more sophisticated because it uses AI. But anyway, the same thing has happened before, and it looks as if it is happening again. And well, on the other occasion, it was a frustrating fact that as soon as one channel was taken down, another one sprung in its place, and for all I know, something similar is now going to happen. Anyway, let me reiterate again, this channel has nothing to do with me. It is taking, without my permission or agreement, my work, and the person who appears in the channel is not me. It is an AI. It is an MI construction. So just to reiterate again, just to repeat again, the only place you will find my authentic work on YouTube is either on this channel or on our main channel, The Duran, and occasionally on other channels where I am a guest. Any other channel, such as this particular channel, which purports to publish me or my work, has absolutely nothing to do with me. Anyway, with that, let me now proceed to the video itself. And let me, of course, before doing so, remind you again to tick the like button. If once you've watched the video, if you like what you've heard and you want to indicate that fact. Now, let's proceed with the video. And let me just say, as I am making this program, that Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, who is currently in Bishkek, which is the capital of Kyrgyzstan, where he is participating in a meeting of the Collective Security Treaty Organization. Well, Putin there is giving a news conference, and the news conference is underway even as I am making this program. So I will obviously have to return to the news conference tomorrow and discuss it in more detail then, but I cannot do so now. Now, the first thing to say is that I am getting some excerpts from this news conference, and I read comments like this. And obviously here he is discussing the 28-point plan that has been circulating, and he has some rather interesting things to say about it. He says this: in general, I have mentioned this many times before, before my visit to the United States, before the visit to Alaska, we discussed this with American negotiators. He means, of course, Steve Witkoff. After that, the list of possible agreements consisting of 28 points emerged. And as I have publicly announced, it was sent to us through certain channels. We reviewed it. Regarding the draft agreement, and again, he's referring to the 28-point document, there are and have been no draft agreements. There was a set of issues that were proposed to be discussed and finalized. And he has said, however, that the discussions, the points that are open to discussion, can be discussed and might form the basis of future agreements. So that is what Putin is saying. And as I said, I haven't got the full details and I haven't got the full picture, but my impression is that what Putin is at pains to make clear, at least judging from these words, and it's a point that I was thinking about a great deal last night and this morning as I was reading various articles which have appeared discussing the 28-point plan, articles which have appeared in places like the American Conservative, Responsible Statecraft, Consortium News, you know, heavyweight, respectable, fine channels, is that many of them appear to be under the impression that the Russians have agreed to the 28 points, that these 28 points represent some kind of consensus which has been reached between the United States and Russia. That is obviously not the case, and Putin is sufficiently worried about the fact, it seems, that he has just made this point clear. There was some kind of understanding reached by Putin and Trump in Alaska. The Russians have talked about this many times. Lavrov has discussed it extensively in various interviews and in at least two press conferences. From what I have been able to understand, this was basically that the United States was prepared to work and accept Istanbul Plus, but that it sought from the Russians some kind of commitment for a transitional ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions. There was no final agreement, however, in Alaska, if only because Trump himself apparently told Putin that before he could proceed further, he needed to discuss the understanding that Putin and Trump had reached with the Ukrainians and with the Europeans, and to get them on side. And according to Putin, according to things that Putin has said in the past, Trump told Putin in Alaska that he was confident that he would be able to get at least Zelensky on side. And the Russians thereafter became increasingly frustrated as the days turned into weeks and the weeks turned into months, and it became increasingly clear that Donald Trump had not succeeded in getting Zelensky or the Europeans on side. So anyway, there was an understanding reached in Alaska, but it was not an agreement. There was certainly no final agreement in Alaska because Trump himself said that there couldn't be. And then after a very complex process, which I've discussed in many programs, a period when the United States, when President Trump seemed to be backing away from what he'd agreed with Putin in Alaska, when there was increasing tensions again between the United States and Russia, and talk of the United States deploying Tomahawk missiles in Ukraine and that kind of thing. After that prolonged process and following an apparently rather contentious call between Putin and Trump, in which Putin pressed Trump to tell him whether or not he was prepared to move forward with the understanding reached in Alaska, and Trump offered instead a summit meeting between himself and Putin in Budapest, a summit meeting that he immediately called off after he found that he still couldn't get Zelensky on side, and after the Treasury Department of the United States imposed sanctions on Rosneft and Lukoil. Anyway, after this incredibly involved and complicated zigzag of a process, the Americans came up with their 28 points, which do derive, or at least do reference back, to the understanding reached between Putin and Trump in Alaska. But it is not a finalized agreement. Nothing like that. The Russians have not signed up to the 28-point plan. Any article in Responsible Statecraft, American Conservative, or wherever, which assumes that, is assuming altogether too much. In fact, I would go further. I would say that it is straightforwardly wrong. And the Russians, Putin, Lavrov, Ushakov, they have already said that the 28 points that they have seen, they have not yet discussed them with the Americans. Some of them are acceptable, others are not. Every one of them requires further discussion and clarification. In other words, if this process continues at all, which as of this moment looks, well, doubtful, but if this process continues at all, we are at best in for a prolonged period of negotiations, of discussions between the Americans and the Russians, and that's not even bringing in the Europeans and the Ukrainians, but a long period of discussion between the Americans and the Russians, and this could take many weeks, or even months, or even longer, until a final agreement is thrashed out. So, the 28 points do not represent an agreement between the United States and Russia. As Putin has said, there was a set of issues that were proposed to be discussed and finalized. So these are discussion points, and for the moment, that is all they are. They're interesting discussion points. They give us a sense of the thinking, the development, the evolution of thinking that is going on within the administration as they become increasingly aware of the military crisis that is playing out in Ukraine. But this is not a proposed agreement or a draft agreement or a proposal that has been sent to the Russians. It is significantly less than that. It's a series of talking points. My colleague and friend, Alex Christoforou, has discussed the 28 points well when he said that they look like something written out in haste on the back of a cocktail napkin. And I think this is just about right. Maybe that's a bit too hard, but not that far anyway from the truth. Anyway, that's what Putin is saying. Now, By contrast, we do have a full, much fuller discussion of this, of the situation from the hard man, if I could put it like that, of the Russian Foreign Ministry, Sergei Ryabkov, who is Russia's deputy foreign minister, and who, as I think I've said before, some people believe will one day replace or succeed Lavrov as Russia's foreign minister. And, well, TASS has provided us with a report, and I will read it out in full. Russian diplomat, and that means, of course, Ryabkov, emphasizes that Moscow will not move any red lines in peace talks. And then there's a direct quotation from Ryabkov. Any concessions and a departure from our approaches to the key aspects of achieving our goals, including those related to the special military operation, are out of the question. And then TASS continues, Moscow welcomes Washington's efforts to find reasonable solutions to the Ukraine issue, but no one should expect Russia to abandon its core positions in the conflict. We welcome the Trump administration's efforts to find reasonable solutions. Various versions of the US plan are subject to talks. Any concessions and a departure from our approaches to the key aspects of achieving our goals, including those related to the special military operation, are out of the question. And we're told that Ryabkov said this at a news conference. And then TASS continues, Ryabkov pointed out that Russia has never wavered from this position. And this is a direct quote from him. It concerns various aspects of the current situation and is largely focused on the underlying causes of the crisis we have been dealing with for quite a long time. Various elements of the Anchorage process are compromises per se. This is the basis we will be guided by once we study the version that is currently on the table and continue discussions. So what Ryabkov is saying here is that the Russians have already made all the concessions that they are prepared to make, and they communicated those concessions to the Americans in Anchorage. Probably, almost certainly, that means a transitional ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions. No one should expect that the Russians will concede more, because they are not going to do so. Yes, they have this set of ideas, this 28-point set of ideas. They haven't, as of now, seen the 19 points that the Americans are talking about, but they obviously know that they exist. If they are in line with Anchorage, well and good. Parts of the 28 points certainly are, and that means that a point for discussion, a table of discussions, has now been drawn up by the Americans, and the Russians are prepared to work with that. But of course, the 19 points, if they stray away from Anchorage, Lavrov has already said that the Russians won't accept it, and nobody anyway should expect the Russians to make more concessions than they already have. It's a pretty uncompromising position, some would say. But saying that does not take fully into account the Russian point of view. I say this because there continues to be this constant repetition in much of the media in the West that the Russians, that Putin, are making maximalist proposals. Istanbul Plus is a maximalist position. Now, When Putin first laid out Istanbul Plus back in June, on the 14th of June 2024, in the speech he gave then to the Russian Foreign Ministry, I said that it would be an incredibly difficult thing for the Western powers to accept Istanbul Plus. It would be something that they would almost certainly choke on. But these demands might seem harsh to many people in the West and indeed to Ukraine. But from a Russian point of view, they fall very far, from very far short of being maximalist. The Russians are, for example, limiting themselves under Istanbul Plus to demanding transfer of the four regions. They accept that Ukraine can retain an army as a result of any peace settlement. They also, incidentally, recognize Odessa and other important cities as Ukrainian. And, well, you could go much further beyond that. You could point out, for example, that Istanbul Plus still accepts the possibility of Ukraine joining the European Union and things of that kind. Now, today, I ought to say that another Russian official, Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Grushko, has had very harsh things to say about the European Union. He says the core of the military policy pursued by NATO and the European Union, which has subordinated itself to NATO, is to prepare the economy, infrastructure, logistics, society, and military for a direct armed conflict with Russia. And Grushko, we're told, said this at a meeting of the Expert Council of the State Duma Committee on International Affairs, which discussed the prospects for changes in the political situation between Russia and the EU. And TASS then goes on to say that according to Grushko, Russia's relations with European countries are currently in a state of deep crisis. By demonizing Russia, they're promoting the idea that a military conflict is inevitable unless Moscow is stopped suffering a strategic defeat. So we see one Russian diplomat, a very senior Russian diplomat, talking about the EU as, in effect, a hostile alliance subordinated to NATO. And Lavrov, Medvedev, other Russian officials have talked about that also. And yet, Istanbul Plus, what Putin set out back on the 14th of June 2024, still allows for Ukraine to join the EU. Now, put it all together, and Istanbul Plus, as we can see, is very, very far, falls very sharp, far short of being a maximalist position from a Russian point of view. A maximalist position, which, by the way, we might eventually end up with if things continue as they are. A maximalist position would be quite different from a Russian point of view. Istanbul Plus is the minimum of what the Russians feel that they can accept in order to protect their core interests. And to the extent that they've made concessions around Istanbul Plus, like agreeing to ceasefires in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, there are already people in Russia who are saying that this is a concession too far and that it should not have been made. And that narrative, by the way, continues to gain traction with quite a lot of people over there. So, coming back to what Ryabkov is saying, and by the way, what I think Putin is also saying. Yes, we're prepared to talk. We're civilized people. If we can achieve our core objectives through negotiations, we will do so. And that is what our allies want us to do. But no one should expect us, as part of a negotiating process, to make more concessions than those we have already made. Those concessions were difficult for us, and there is an awful lot amongst these 28 points which continues to be unacceptable to us. And of course, if the 19-point plan, which we haven't yet seen, strays even further from what we agreed in Anchorage, then obviously that would be unacceptable in its totality. So when I said that this is a stark warning, it needs to be interpreted and understood correctly, which I suspect, unfortunately, in the West, it never is. Anyway, there we go. That's the Russians. The Russians have made their position clear. Putin is in Bishkek. He is in Kyrgyzstan. I presume he will be visiting India. Reports say on the 3rd of December. There might be time between Putin going, returning to Moscow, and then flying on to India for him to meet with Witkoff at Kushner and perhaps Driscoll in Moscow. But the scheduling is going to be very tight. In the meantime, in the United States, we now have what is starting to look like the beginning of a domestic political crisis because, as I discussed in my program yesterday, as we discussed on the Duran in a live stream with our guest, Robert Barnes, the US attorney, with, as I said, his finger on all of the things that are taking place in American politics. Anyway, it's clear that there is a massive and escalating pushback in Washington against any move to negotiate with the Russians at all. So we've had these leaks. And by the way, I think it was yesterday, the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service, the SVR, said that they believe that the people who are behind the leaks of the Witkoff conversations with Ushakov and Dmitriev, anyway, they believe, the Russians believe, that the party that has published these leaks is the British. Now, I ought to say, the Russians do have a tendency to blame the British for everything, and there are many, many opponents to this negotiation process in the United States. And of course, we don't know, I don't know for a fact that these recordings that are circulating are even real recordings of actual conversations that Witkoff had with Dmitriev and with Ushakov. For the record, I think they are. I've read the extracts. To me, frankly, they look completely innocuous. I cannot see anything there that is inappropriate or improper in any way. I realize that some people are complaining that Witkoff was coaching Ushakov as to what Putin should say to Trump on the eve of the telephone conversation between the two in order to get Trump on side. Well, Donald Trump isn't bothered, so I'm not sure why anybody else should be. Anyway, let me just make that very clear. I don't find anything wrong with that at all, by the way. At least the extent to which that happened. I mean, when subordinates of leaders discuss possible discussions between their chiefs, they will inevitably discuss points like this. I don't see how conversations can usefully take place if they don't. But anyway, these leaks have now appeared. The Russians are alleging the British were behind them. The Russians always, as I said, tend to think the British are behind everything. There are plenty of people in Washington who, it seems to me, are as hostile to this process as anyone in London. And I would have thought it more plausible that it was they rather than the British who leaked these calls. I say that, though I understand that the media in the United States is now saying that it was, in fact, a European intelligence agency that provided these recordings, and I believe they're actual recordings to Bloomberg specifically. And European intelligence agency does rather imply that it was indeed the British. Now that, of course, begs multiple questions. If it was the British, first of all, how do the Russians know that it was the British? I mean, that's already an interesting question in itself, which obviously aficionados at the spy game can devote their time trying to figure out. I'm not going to try. There is, of course, the other thing to say, though, which is if it was the British or a European intelligence agency, then are we being asked to believe that the British and or that other European intelligence agency are monitoring Witkoff's calls? Because it's clear to me that it is Witkoff's phone that is being monitored here. At least that's how it seems to me. Isn't it more likely, and this is still my view, that it was the American intelligence community that was monitoring the calls? They probably would want to monitor any call that Ushakov or Dmitriev make, because they could argue, legitimately, it seems to me, that that is their job. So I could see how that might have happened. But it could be, and this is just my theory, and I want to stress it is only a theory, that somebody in Washington, conscious that for an American to leak this information to the media would break the law in the United States, might have passed these recordings, copies of these recordings, on to a Five Eyes partner, Britain, and with the understanding that it would be the British who would then leak the calls. Let me stress again, that is purely my own theory, working theory. I don't know whether it is true. And perhaps one shouldn't spend too much time worrying about it. But anyway, this leak of these calls, which, by the way, I absolutely think should be thoroughly investigated by the American law enforcement authorities. I'll be interested to see if that happens, by the way. But anyway, these calls, innocuous as they are, have achieved their effect. All sorts of people, members of Congress, other people outside Congress, are frothing and furious about them. One member of Congress in a message on X has called Witkoff a traitor. I cannot for the life of me understand on what possible basis. Other members of Congress are saying that secret negotiations of this kind should never be permitted. Secret negotiations in diplomacy take place all the time. Saying that there should be no secret discussions means abolishing diplomacy entirely, because without secret discussions, there can be no diplomacy. That is an obvious point, which, of course, everybody knows. But anyway, what another member of Congress is making that really quite astonishing claim. And, well, there are now demands that Witkoff, who we're being told again is either traitorous or incompetent or inexperienced or out of his depth, should be sacked. Sacked before he goes to Moscow. And the purpose of all of this, all of these leaks, all of this narrative that's being spun, is not, I think, actually to get Witkoff sacked. For the moment, the president, Donald Trump, continues to support Witkoff, and I expect will continue to support Witkoff. I don't think there's any real risk for Witkoff of being sacked, at least not at the present time. But the real purpose is to develop this theory that the 28 points were drawn up by Dmitriev, that they are Russian talking points, which the Trump administration has weakly accepted. Russian talking points, most of which, just to say, are, as I have discussed already, unacceptable to Russia. I mean, this is the Alice in Wonderland world in which we now find ourselves. But again, it's not the substance of the points that there is so much objection to. Obviously, it is the idea of having talks about Ukraine with the Russians at all. And we've had more information, incidentally, about how fraught and difficult the situation is. It turns out that before Rubio, Marco Rubio, the US Secretary of State, took Witkoff and Driscoll with him to Geneva to meet the Ukrainians and the Europeans there, Driscoll, who had just been to Kiev, where he'd passed on the 28 points to Zelensky, Driscoll had been intending to fly to London to meet the Europeans there too. But the reception to him, he figured out that the reception to him would be so hostile and so unwilling to listen to anything that he was saying that he called the entire trip off. Bear in mind that previously in Istanbul, Witkoff himself had been expected to meet Umerov, Zelensky's representative, who is still the Secretary of the Ukrainian National Defense and Security Council. Anyway, Witkoff called that meeting off when he realized that Umerov would make proposals, would insist on demands that Witkoff knew would be unacceptable to the Russians. So, anyway, the crisis is developing in the United States. The Europeans, the Ukrainians, the hardliners in the United States, the hardliners in Washington, are doing everything they can to stop these negotiations in their tracks and to discredit them and to make out that this is all based on Russian proposals, even though that is obviously not the case. And already also there are the insinuations circulating again that Trump has some kind of arrangement or connection or affinity for the Russians and for Putin, and is therefore suspect in some mysterious way, which no one can ever nowadays explain. So anyway, there we go. This is where we are. We are now, as I said, at the beginning of a crisis in the United States. And frankly, as I discussed a few programs ago, I can't really see how it could be otherwise. I said a couple of programs ago that I felt, based on what I had learnt about the understandings that Putin and Trump reached in Alaska, that it would be impossible for Trump to sell the Alaska proposals in the United States to the political class there, let alone to Europe and to the Ukrainians. And I was surprised that he went so far as to think he could. And I'm afraid I believe this to be so of this set of proposals as well. And I'm afraid I believe this to be so of this latest set of proposals as well. In fact, my overwhelming concern is not that this process will fail. I take that practically as a given. But that when it fails, we're going to find ourselves facing again across Europe and in the United States another massive drumbeat for further escalation. And that Donald Trump, embarrassed and humiliated by his failure to deliver on his promises to Putin, which he made in Alaska, will feel impelled to agree to these demands for escalation, in part in order to save face, but also because his political position in the United States after this episode will have weakened with the story, the narrative, which, to repeat, is a false narrative, that he is somehow under the thumb of the Russians, having gained traction again. In which case, we could start to see very alarming things, like Tomahawk cruise missiles deployed to Ukraine, further sanctions against the Russian energy industry, things of that kind taking place. Well, anyway, there we go. That's what I wanted to say about the negotiations at the moment. As I said, Putin at the moment is in Bishkek. Realistically, nothing much more can happen until Putin returns to Moscow. But the Russians are now giving absolutely clear signals that Anchorage is as far as they are prepared to go, and that they are not able to go further. And just to make it clear, Ryabkov, even though he tends to be the toughest amongst the Russian foreign ministry officials when speaking about this crisis, I have absolutely no doubt at all that he's doing so with the full authority of the Russian foreign ministry and of the Russian government. So anyway, that then brings us back to the ongoing situation, the situation in the war. And here there have been further developments, and they continue to be in the same direction as previously, with further Russian advances. Now, I understand that last night the Russians conducted another major drone and missile strike against Ukraine. The primary target apparently was Western Ukraine. There is little information about this strike from Ukrainian sources. The Russian Defense Ministry has made its own comments about it. It says that operational tactical aviation, attack drones, missile troops and the artillery, the Russian groups of forces have inflicted damage on warehouses and command posts of drone vehicles, a satellite communication center, Ukrainian energy facilities used by the armed forces of Ukraine, as well as temporary deployment areas of Ukrainian armed formations and foreign mercenaries in 148 areas. So that's all the Russian Defense Ministry is telling us about this strike. I will obviously discuss it in more detail tomorrow, when I presume there will be a lot more information. But in the meantime, the Russian advance along the front lines continues, and it is continuing and accelerating in every area. Now, last night and this morning, there were further reports of fighting going on inside the town of Zaporozhye in southeastern in the town of Guliapolye in southeastern Zaporozhye region. Now, information, detailed information about the fighting here is relatively sparse, and I will say straight away that I have not myself seen any videos of Russian troops in Guliapolye. I have seen plenty of footage now of Russian bombs landing on Guliapolye, and it does seem as if the town is being bombed in a way which would be consistent with a storming operation being underway. I have no doubt that the Russians are indeed storming Guliapolye. I don't know how much of it they do control at the moment. Probably something like 10-20%. But as I've discussed already, Guliapolye is a relatively small place. It's about 15,000 people. And whilst obviously there are buildings and there's defences which the Ukrainians have created in this area, it cannot be very long before this town falls. Further to the north, there is more information now coming from Pokrovsk. And firstly, I will go to what the Russian Defense Ministry is saying about the Pokrovsk situation. They say that in Pokrovsk, assault groups of the Second Army are successfully advancing northwards in the Tsentralny and Dinas districts. Russian troops continue mopping up Ukrainian militants in Rivne. This is the village that lies between Pokrovsk and Mirnograd. 8 attacks of the 425th Assault Regiment and the 95th Air Assault Regiment of the Ukrainian Army in order to unblock the encircled Ukrainian grouping have been repelled from the air, These attacks were launched from the area of the village of Grishino. So what the Russians are saying is that they have completed their mopping up operation of the southern and central areas of Pokrovsk. These were the more heavily fortified areas with the higher, the taller apartment buildings. And they're now moving northwards and they're clearing up the remnants of the Ukrainian troops in northern Pokrovsk as well. Now, there's been a lot of discussion about the situation in Pokrovsk. The Ukrainians have made various claims about successful counterattacks in Pokrovsk. As predictably happens, some of the Russian channels have repeated these claims. This is not unusual, by the way. To me, this all reminds me very much of what happened earlier this year, after the Russians captured the town of Toretsk, which lies somewhat to the north and east. The Ukrainians, for several weeks, pretended that fighting in Toretsk was still underway. They launched various raids deep into Toretsk itself. None of them were able to maintain positions anywhere in Toretsk for any time. And as I understand it, quite a few Ukrainian soldiers died as a result of these raids. But the image, the story of a continued battle for Toretsk was perpetuated in the media for a while. Now, Radovka, the Russian newspaper based in Smolensk, which, as I said, reports very, very thoroughly about the fighting around Pokrovsk, says that essentially the same thing is happening. That if we're talking about northern Pokrovsk, the Russians have not yet fully consolidated their control here. This allows for gaps and places where Ukrainian groups can infiltrate. They can break into Pokrovsk and create the impression that there is still fighting going on. And I've no doubt that this is essentially the truth. The giveaway is that the Russians appear to be clearing Rivne as well, which is an important village to the northeast of Pokrovsk, actually exactly to the east of Pokrovsk, but bordering the northern parts of Pokrovsk. The fact that the Russians are clearing Rivne is a sign, as far as I'm concerned, that they control most of northern Pokrovsk as well. So this is the battle that appears to be taking place there. I think there are more clearing operations than anything else. There have been more reports, incidentally, recently, that the Russians have pushed the Ukrainians out of Rodinska, where the Ukrainians had managed to regain some positions in the north of the town, and that the Russians, having completed the recapture of Vladimirovka, now are in secure control of the territory to the northeast of Pokrovsk as well, the area where the Russians carried out their breakthrough in August. And apparently there is drone footage which confirms this. Now, the main battle continues to be in Mirnograd, which is, of course, located to the east of Pokrovsk. And this is what the Russian Defense Ministry has to say about the fighting in Mirnograd. In Mirnograd, assault detachments of the 51st Army continue to push the enemy out of Vostochny and Zapadny districts and the southern part of the town. 117 buildings have been liberated. Now, again, 117 buildings captured over the course of a single 24-hour period suggests a collapse. And in fact, there's apparently video footage of Ukrainian troops taking prisoner some Russian troops who were in the center of Mirnograd, which strongly suggests that the Russians have now reached central Mirnograd as well, and this fighting is taking place there also. So, the clearing operation of the cauldron continues, the Pokrovsk cauldron continues. There are large numbers of Ukrainian troops still to defeat and round up, but the operation appears to be continuing steadily, though perhaps that understates some of its complexities. Now, one of the things I would say is that the Ukrainians have been focused massively on trying to delay as long as they can the collapse of Pokrovsk. And it's not difficult to understand why, because this is the battle that has attracted the main international attention. And Russian commentaries, and here I think they're reliable, and by the way, Ukrainian commentators as well, are now saying that the result has been that because of the excessive concentration of Ukrainian troops in the Pokrovsk area, other areas of the battlefronts, such as Zaporozhye and the Siversk-Liman area, have been left weakened, enabling rapid Russian advances there. Now, 2 days ago, Rydovka said that the Ukrainian command has now finally accepted that a breakthrough operation to enable the Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd to escape is impossible, and that they have now started to withdraw troops, units from the Pokrovsk area and to redeploy them to other unstable positions along the front lines. Well, the Russian Defense Ministry is not telling us anything of this sort, but it would not surprise me. Now, one of those unstable positions appears to be the Siversk-Liman area. Now, Siversk has been a town that the Russians have been trying to capture since the summer of 2022. They've made many attempts to capture it. It is heavily fortified. It is relatively small. It is on an elevation. The brigade that defended itself in Siversk, the Ukrainian brigade, was apparently highly trained and very tough and highly motivated. And I get the sense that it was well commanded as well. And for a long time, rather like was the case with Ugledar in the south, which the Russians finally captured in the autumn of last year. Well, for a long time, Russian attempts to capture Siversk were unsuccessful. But about 5 days ago, the Russians conclusively broke into Siversk, and there's been fighting going on in Siversk. The Russians have claimed that they've been fighting in Siversk for several weeks, but it was only over the last week or so that conclusive confirmation of this appeared. And yesterday, reports began to circulate and continue to circulate this morning that resistance, Ukrainian resistance in Siversk has collapsed, that the Ukrainians have lost control of the center of Siversk and of the eastern areas of Siversk, and that they're retreating behind a railway line. Again, there are many railway lines in this area. And perhaps also ultimately the small river, the Bakhmutka River, that divides Siversk. Not in two, most of Siversk is to the east of the Bakhmutka River, but there is a small area of Siversk that lies to the west of it. Now, again, to repeat, I am not there. I have no video footage. I've not seen any video footage yet, which confirms the situation, but it would not surprise me. The roads to Siversk are now mostly cut. Supplies reaching the garrison in Siversk must be few. The town is relatively small. The Russians are in overwhelming strength. So it would make complete sense if Ukrainian resistance is collapsing and if the Ukrainian garrison, tough and resilient as it has been, has now made the decision that perhaps the moment has come for them to start thinking about retreating westwards. It would be a long and very difficult retreat. The villages of Yampol and Platonovka and other villages to the west of Siversk are under Russian control. The Russians have drone control and physical control also of some of the roads. There are Ukrainian-held villages to the southwest of Siversk, but reaching them would require a long trek across the fields. It is, of course, now late autumn. Probably the weather conditions are difficult. And, of course, the Russians would be there hunting whatever Ukrainian troops were trying to escape from Siversk in that way. Nonetheless, I suspect that that is what is about to happen. It is very similar to what happened in Ugledar. There also, there was a sudden collapse of resistance. The garrison fled north to villages that the Ukrainians still controlled at that time. All of these villages have now, by the way, passed under the control of the Russians, well, long since done so, in fact. But anyway, some men from the two brigades that had been defending Ugledar were able to escape and reach these villages, though the main part of the forces was destroyed. And I suspect something like that is again going to happen in Siversk this time. So that's what I think is happening. There are reports that Siversk is about to fall. It could happen tonight, perhaps tomorrow. Well, we shall see. The other news is of an accelerating battle taking place in Liman. Liman is a bigger town than Siversk, a significantly bigger town than Siversk, but apparently in some respects it is more difficult to defend. And the reports say that the Russians have entered Liman now from multiple directions, from the north and from the south, and that there is still fighting going on in Liman, but that the Russians are again storming the town fast, and that resistance in Liman is happening and is accelerating. But anyway, the collapse of resistance in Liman is accelerating. Again, there is a dearth of footage, but for the record, I suspect that the reports are basically true. Anyway, there it is. More Russian advances, a gathering collapse, a collapse of the garrison in Mirnograd. Mirnograd maybe, as I said, coming to an end. The various battles in Pokrovsk, Mirnograd coming to an end. It's been pointed out to me that given that the Russians have wanted the Ukrainians to keep most of their reserves in the Pokrovsk area to enable the more rapid advances in Zaporozhye region and in Liman and Siversk, that the Russians might actually have chosen a slower pattern of advance in Mirnograd than they were able to do. Possibly. Again, I'm not sufficiently expert in these things to be able to say. But anyway, Guliapolye apparently being stormed, perhaps resistance collapsing there, resistance in Siversk perhaps having already collapsed, and Ukraine likely to lose Liman before long. Now, there is a view that has been gaining increasing traction that the major focus for the Russians is, in fact, not Donbass at all, but Zaporozhye region, that the Russians have now covered half the distance between Velikaya Novosilka and the city of Zaporozhye from the east. They are, of course, very close to Zaporozhye city in the south, where they're continuing to advance on Stepnogorsk. And Rydovka yesterday claimed that the Russians are preparing a storming operation of the next town after Guliapolye, which is Orekhov, where they have already captured the village of Malaya Tokmachka, which is best understood as a suburb of Orekhov. So, well, this is possible. I still retain the sense that the major battle for the Russians continues to be Donbass, and that the priority for the Russians is to complete the battle of Donbass, to break the line of fortified cities, to finish the battles for Pokrovsk and Konstantinovka, which is located immediately to the east, and then begin the final great encirclement operation of the Ukrainian forces in the towns of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. And, well, as I've said already, that battle may not be as far off as many people believe. If Kupiansk has already fallen, if Siversk and Liman fall very soon, then it's likely that Izium will follow quickly after, and in which case the Russians will be in a position to encircle the Slavyansk Kramatorsk conurbation from the north, and with Pokrovsk and Konstantinivka likely to fall fairly soon, they will be able to encircle the Slavyansk Kramatorsk conurbation from the south. The big question will be, for me, whether the Ukrainians will defend themselves in Slavyansk Kramatorsk, or whether they will finally make the decision to retreat from these two cities in order to avoid encirclement. If that is what they intend eventually to do, and it would be logical for them to do so, then it makes even less sense than it does at the moment for the Ukrainians to want to cling on to Slavyansk and Kramatorsk and to make this a sticking point in the negotiations which Trump is trying to set up with the Russians. Anyway, there it is. I don't myself think that this negotiation is going to lead anywhere. As I said, my major concern is that its failure is not used as an excuse for further escalation. Anyway, there are other things going on in the world, and perhaps the most alarming is a massive quarrel that has broken out between China and Japan, with the Japanese Prime Minister, the newly appointed Japanese Prime Minister, who comes from the nationalist spectrum of Japanese politics, making some, I thought, incredibly ill-judged and unnecessary comments about Taiwan, appearing to speak about Taiwan as if it was a country independent of China, and speaking of Taiwan as a place which Japan would want to defend in case there was a Chinese attempt to conquer it. Now, anybody who is familiar with the Chinese perspective of things would know that such language, especially coming from Japan, would be certain to raise hackles in China. And I understand that not only is this the case, but the Chinese social media, which is very active and very vocal, is absolutely on fire. And that there's a lot of talk there that if the Japanese want a battle, a fight, then China is ready for it. And the point, of course, is for many Chinese that Japan's aggressions against China in the late 19th century and early 20th century were ultimately the reason why China lost control of Taiwan in the first place. Japan conquered and took control of Taiwan, which is how it became separated from China. It was returned to China at the end of the Second World War, but that was the time when China was still governed by the Kuomintang government of Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek, anti-communist and ally of the United States. When General Chiang Kai-shek and the Kuomintang lost the civil war on the mainland to Mao Zedong's People's Liberation Army, and the Communist Party of China gained control of China, Chiang Kai-shek retreated to Taiwan, taking with him, by the way, many of the treasures of the Forbidden City in Beijing, which is still, as a result, in Taiwan, and retreated obviously to that island, which meant that again, Taiwan became divided or separated from China, from the Chinese mainland. So, given this history, for Japan, of all countries, to be talking in this way, especially given the very vivid memories in China of the terrible war that Japan fought against China, starting from the 1930s, some say from 1937, but Japan already had a significant presence in China before then. Anyway, the terrible war that Japan fought against China, starting in 1937 and continuing all the way until Japan's capitulation in September 1945. For the Chinese, as is often overlooked in the West, the Second World War began not in 1939, as it does in Britain and France and in Poland, Britain, France and Poland and elsewhere in Europe, and not in 1941, as it did for Russia and the United States. For China, the Second World War began in 1937, much earlier. Anyway, given all of these very powerful historical memories, it is completely unsurprising that opinion in China has been massively inflamed by these, in my opinion, reckless comments by the Japanese Prime Minister. And apparently, and I haven't seen these myself, but there have also been speculations floating around that Japan might revisit the idea of acquiring nuclear weapons, and that the Japanese fleet, which is significant and powerful, could participate in any defense of Taiwan. So this has created a huge, massive row between China and Japan. And the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, has responded to this by telephoning Donald Trump in Washington, in the United States. And if you read the Chinese readout, it's absolutely clear that the discussion was primarily about Taiwan and about Japan, and Xi Jinping reminded Trump that China and the United States had been allies in the war against Japan during the Second World War, and therefore had a joint responsibility to preserve to protect the outcome of the Second World War and to defeat militarism and fascism and all of those things that were the legacies and the causes of the Second World War. Now, Donald Trump doesn't seem to have understood that what Xi Jinping was calling him about was these comments from Japan. Trump's comment about this conversation with Xi Jinping on Truth Social was that Xi Jinping was mainly talking about agriculture, soybeans, and all of those kind of things again. I've no doubt that all that was discussed, but that is not why Xi Jinping telephoned Donald Trump. It is, in fact, almost unprecedented for a Chinese president to initiate a conversation with a foreign leader. The last time that a Chinese president contacted the president of the United States was in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. I've read, in fact, that that was the only other occasion when the Chinese initiated a president-to-president call. All other calls, apart from the one that has just happened, were initiated by the United States. So it is extremely unusual for the Chinese to do this, and it is a sign of how seriously Xi Jinping and the Chinese leadership are taking this situation. Now, it's hardly a mystery, a secret, that in China, there are many, many people who believe that Japan would not have been acting in this way, would not be making these comments, had it not been put up to do so by the United States. And indeed, I have read many articles in the American military and foreign policy media space dominated as they both are by neocon thinking. Are the United States trying to enlist its Pacific allies, mostly and specifically Japan, in the defense of Taiwan? So when Xi Jinping telephones Trump and tells Trump this is a bad situation and you must respond, he is obviously at one level expecting Trump to call the Japanese to heel, but at the same time he's delivering a warning. He's basically telling the US president, look, this situation is getting very, very bad. Bringing the Japanese into this conflict is the worst possible thing you can do, given how we in China feel about Taiwan and also about Japan and about our recent history with Japan. And you must stop. And I'm sorry to say that I don't get the impression that Trump has understood how pressing this is. Now, about a week or two weeks ago, Xi Jinping and Trump met in South Korea. There was an agreement cobbled together to get through the immediate trade problems. The Chinese somewhat relaxed their restrictions on rare earth exports, though, as I understand it, by nowhere near as much as the Americans expected that they would. There have been no substantive trade negotiations between China and the United States since then, however, and the rhetoric from the United States has become again increasingly aggressive. Now, about 2 weeks ago, a big report, article was published by the RAND Corporation, which appeared to suggest that the United States should seek some kind of understanding with China rather than confrontation with it. That appears to have raised hackles with some people in Washington, because as I understand it, the RAND Corporation has deleted that article now from its site. So the stage is being set for a renewed confrontation, or so it seems to me, between China and the United States. Now, Donald Trump probably doesn't understand this, but he really does need to grasp that in China, this is considered an existential issue. Just as Ukraine is considered an existential issue in Russia, Taiwan, perhaps even more so, is considered an existential issue in China. The Chinese will not back down over Taiwan or even compromise over Taiwan. Compromise over Taiwan is not on China's agenda. It is not part of its political language. The Chinese have actually formally said that it is for them, the issue of Taiwan and Taiwanese independence is for them an immovable red line. Now, China has been undergoing a major naval build-up. China has completed construction of its first supercarrier. There are rather impressive photos of it. This supercarrier is not in operation, and realistically, it would probably take several years before the Chinese were to acquire full competence in how to operate a weapon system as complex and as huge and as advanced as a supercarrier. But the Chinese already possess powerful military assets around Taiwan, and of course they also have further leverage over the United States. If we're talking about the issue of rare earths, for example, the Chinese restricted exports of rare earths to the United States and to the US's Western allies during the various trade disputes, but the Chinese have always made it clear that they regard exports of rare earths also as a national security issue. In fact, their latest regulations on controlling exports of rare earths are expressly phrased as being in order to protect Chinese security. So if the Chinese get the sense that the Americans and the Japanese are ganging up now with the Taiwanese authorities against them in order to achieve some kind of separation, a formal separation of Taiwan from China, then there is every reason to think that the Chinese will start to take immediate retaliatory measures like stopping further exports of rare earths to the United States, and they have now the machinery, the mechanisms in order to do that. So that, at the very least, it seems to me, is an option, given how important rare earths are, apparently, for the advanced manufacturing techniques the United States uses in order to develop many of its most advanced military equipment, including its F-35 fighter jets. So the United States may be closer to that point than it understands. And of course, if the Chinese are goaded further, a Chinese military attack on Taiwan might take place. The Chinese have never ruled it out. They've always reserved the right to do it if they feel that Taiwan is indeed in danger, as they would say, of seceding. And again, I don't think that the United States, the Donald Trump, fully understands the risks here. If the Chinese president calls you, that is his sign that the situation is becoming extremely fraught, and it is extremely unwise in that case to mistake the message. A call from the Chinese president is itself a message going beyond what the Chinese president even says over the course of the call itself. Now, the United States is still bogged down in Ukraine. Dan Driscoll has just told the Europeans that the Russians are not only producing missiles at a much faster rate than the entire collective West, but they're even stockpiling them. So they're not using all of their missiles to strike at Ukraine, despite the fact that they are conducting missile strikes against Ukraine now on a regular basis. The United States cannot keep up, neither has the entire collective West been able to keep up. How is the collective West going to be able to keep up with China, which has a far bigger manufacturing base than Russia does, if we get into this kind of conflict? And how can the United States conduct a conflict simultaneously against China over Taiwan, even with Japan also involved, while still bogged down trying to help Ukraine? It boggles the mind that there should be people in Washington who are not alarmed and worried about this prospect. A few are. Elbridge Colby at the Pentagon apparently is, but according to the American Conservative and Robert Barnes, when he spoke to us over the course of the recent live stream, the hardliners, the neocons in the Senate, led by Senator Lindsey Graham and presumably Senator Mitch McConnell, are blocking all of the appointments of Elbridge Colby's intended team, who are supposed to join him in the Pentagon. So it seems that the hardliners are unreconciled to any moves towards rapprochement with China. They managed to get that article that appeared in Rand taken down, and they're blocking Elbridge Colby's appointments, and they're perhaps instigating Japan to take the current line that it is taking. And they are blocking any move to end the conflict in Ukraine, any negotiation to end the conflict in Ukraine. The military logic of all of this completely escapes me. Go to war with everybody at the same time, even though their resources massively exceed your own. Well, a certain person in Berlin tried to do that in the 1940s, and we all know what became of him. But another figure who tried to do something similar, and whom I know perhaps more about than most, was the Count Duke of Olivares, who was the Prime Minister of Spain in the 17th century and was the chief minister of the King of Spain, Philip IV. And Olivares knew that there were problems in Spain. He had an ambitious program for reform, which he was never able to carry through. But at the same time, he was obsessed with maintaining and expanding Spain's power in Europe. And of course, Spain at that time was by far the most powerful country in Europe. So before long, he ended up fighting in Europe. Spain ended up in a war in Europe against pretty much everybody. France, most of the German Swiss states, Sweden. And of course, it proved to be a disaster. And eventually, people in Spain, in Madrid, concluded that Olivares was actually mad. And that was why, one of the reasons why he was forced into retirement. And the view has begun to gain traction that he might indeed have suffered from some kind of acute mental disorder to have led Spain into this impossible position. Well, I hesitate to say that the people in Congress, the people in the deep state, who obstruct every move towards negotiation or reconciliation or détente with any one of America's adversaries at a time when America is indeed already severely overextended. I hesitate to say that these people are mad. I mean, I've no knowledge of their clinical condition, so I cannot say that. But I do wonder whether, if the disaster does eventually come, whether some person in the future might eventually come to a conclusion rather like that. Anyway, this is where I finish my program today. Let me remind you again that you can find all our videos on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X, and also our new Substack site. And if you want to support our work, you can do so by Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Thank you again. More from me soon. Have a very good day.